This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, we'll find out what's behind the growing number of homeless seniors in Collier County. The Hunger and Homeless Coalition of Collier County added a new senior citizen category this year to its annual homeless point-in-time count. We'll sit down with the organization's executive director to find out more. But first, we've covered issues associated with the opioid crisis and opioid addiction on this show for years, from the days when Florida was struggling against the pill mill crisis, when pain management clinics were springing up everywhere, and prescription painkillers are being distributed seemingly with little concern for the possible long-term repercussions, to addicts' move to heroin, which is now being tainted with fentanyl, which is a big factor behind the increase in the number of opioid-related deaths in Florida. Deaths from opioids rose 35% in 2016, according to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. But one segment of the population that you don't hear much about is older Americans and Floridians who are more frequently becoming addicted to opioids. According to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, opioid abuse among those 50 and older has nearly doubled over the past decade. We're joined in studio by Brenda Iliff. She's the executive director of the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation in Naples. Brenda, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you so much, Julie.
We're also joined in studio by Claire Mannion. She is a retired Southwest Floridian who has struggled with addiction to multiple substances, including opioids, and who sought treatment at Hazelden. Claire, thanks so much for coming in to share your story with us today.
Happy to be here, Julie.
Have you or someone you know found themselves struggling with opioid addiction? You can give us a call now to join our conversation. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So, Brenda, for starters, can you remind me how long you've been working in the world of addiction treatment?
You know, I worked in addiction treatment, particularly for Hazelden Betty Ford, on and off for over 20 years, and I've gotten to watch lots of lives change.
Well, yeah, and a lot of things have changed.
A lot of things have changed.
Was it primarily alcohol addiction that you were working with in the beginning, and it's gotten more towards opioids?
It changes. So I worked through the cocaine epidemic, I worked through the meth epidemic, and now we're in the opioid epidemic. But I'll tell you, the opioid epidemic has made the others not seem like epidemics.
Really? Is that much worse?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In 2016, we had 63,000 people overdose. That's more in 1 year than when all the people that were killed in the Vietnam War.
That's quite a number. We had you on the show a few months ago talking about fentanyl. Is that, would we say that's the main culprit?
No, absolutely not. No. Fentanyl is hitting the streets, but pretty much you have to get it illegally, and people are overdosing. So that clearly has a strong impact on
the
overdose rates. Absolutely. Yep, because people are unknowingly taking fentanyl when they take their heroin.
And that's when somebody's moved from the prescription pills to pills that they've obtained maybe without a doctor possibly. Then when they can't get any more of those, then they go to the heroin.
Yeah.
And then that heroin's being cut in with fentanyl to just make it that much harder.
Can be. Sometimes.
But about how many would you say, and I know you don't have hard numbers or you may not have hard numbers on this, how many would you say are strictly opioid pill users that go all the way to an overdose?
Generally, what they're finding is about a third of the people who are overdosing are there's benzodiazepines in their system, which benzodiazepines are anxiety drugs or sleeping drugs. Generally, with people who are older, it can be a trifecta. You've got the opioid, you've got the sleeping and or anxiety drug, and then alcohol is usually in there too.
Is that what puts it over the edge for a lot of people?
No, it's the opioid that puts it over the edge.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
So how are you seeing your numbers right now? I know that you're in Collier County, so we have a larger senior population to begin with.
We do. But we also at Hazelden Betty Ford in Naples specialize in people who are 50 and older because we know it's different for them. They get introduced generally later in life, so they may not have had a problem their whole life. They have different needs while they're in treatment. They want to be with a group that's their age. They want people that understand what it's like to have had this full life and then all of a sudden addiction hits you.
It just trips you right up.
It does. And
this is also when you get into an age zone where you do have aches and pains or you do
have arthritis.
Absolutely.
And that's one of the risk factors for addiction to opioids or at least opioid misuse. You know, as we age, we might have arthritis. That's painful. So, or people may have struggle sleeping. They may have a surgery. You know, a 22-year-old who's had a shoulder surgery may get addicted to opioids through the process. But eventually, they're going to get cut off from those meds. But a 65, 80-year-old probably will have long-term access to the opioids through their medical provider.
I'm thinking of that dynamic. When you have a doctor in the doctor's office looking at a 22-year-old, they're usually older than that 22-year-old because, well, they have a doctorate education.
Yeah, absolutely.
It would be maybe a little bit easier to say, no, you can't do that anymore. But I wonder if it's difficult for doctors to address someone who's as old as their parents.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And to say no.
It's hard to say no when people are in pain. And you know there's a valid reason for the pain. But, you know, the Joint Commission has told us that you have to treat the pain. You have to assess for pain. But it doesn't say you have to treat it with narcotics. And unfortunately, our society has said, well, let's treat it with narcotics.
Are there many doctors in Collier County and Naples area that are looking at alternative ways to address these pain issues?
There are. One of the problems is the funding. You know, like while Medicare will pay for opioids for the pain pills, it might not necessarily pay for another alternative that it's helpful for people, such as massage or acupuncture or biofeedback or even medications that can take away some of the cravings of alcohol or, excuse me, of opiates.
Well, any addictive substance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? It's just kind of – it seems really backwards. Do you foresee any kind of change with Medicare being making it less easy to obtain these opioids and
yes.
offering more opportunities for different kinds of pain treatment?
Limiting the opioids. In fact, many states, including Florida, have given some guidelines. The CDC has given guidelines. FDA has given guidelines saying – and Florida has written it into legislation that for the first – exposure to some sort of need for pain, they are recommending you can give 3 days or up to seven if you have a special recommendation of some sort. Now, that takes palliative care, the cancer care. That's
off a different
story.
Table.
Absolutely. So we need to treat that in a different way. But the legislatures are clearly shutting down some of the access people have to.
Well, it kind of, though, ends up legislatively tying the hands of a doctor who would want to be the one to make those decisions.
I mean, healthcare providers don't like that.
The Congress people did not get the doctorate in pain management,
right.
They didn't go to all that schooling, and they're not looking at the patient saying, oh, no, you're just going to have to be in pain now.
Yeah. And the other piece is doctors, like if you have a surgery and they give you 3 days, yes, you can call back and get more, but then that takes them off the line and, you know, it's a lot of work for people not to give. But also when people give 90 days for a surgery where you really need maybe 2 days, it gets people addicted.
And we talked a little bit earlier in the beginning of the show, too, about Medicare and how it handles treatment options. I looked it up and it's kind of hard to navigate that.
Yeah, it doesn't really. It pretty much says we'll pay for treatment if it's in a hospital. Well, how many hospitals do you know that do treatment long-term?
Yes, Medicare Part A, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So that's the hospitalization segment.
Yes, yes. So generally it'll pay for detox for folks. So if someone needs to go to detox in a medical unit.
But how many people go out of detox and just walk away and they're fine?
Well, no, very few. In fact, the research is very clear that even if you give people medications for addiction, they still need counseling of some sort.
And then in other areas of Medicare, do they do any kind of other support for maybe medications that help keep you from wanting more of the opioid? Or
it's spotty at times. Medicare generally won't pay for methadone. We're seeing some folks that are getting some help sometimes from their supplemental insurances for anti-craving meds such as naltrexone, which can be helpful when you're getting off the opioids.
So when people come to Hazelden, is that one of the things that you're able to offer? Is that help in navigating Medicare?
Yes, absolutely. And there's certain programs that can – not so much navigating Medicare. It's more the supplemental insurances. But a lot of times they won't pay if Medicare won't pay. So people can be in a double bind. But there are resources like David Lawrence has a specialized group that has – they have some access to some government grants for folks with medication-assisted treatment.
So people are kind of – left to search professional organizations that have been lucky enough to achieve grants or get some money given to them to cover
it. Or doctors. Doctors can prescribe buprenorphine, which is an anti-craving type med for the opioids. So that's one of the pluses of the buprenorphine. Suboxone, you might hear it called, is it can be prescribed out of a doctor's office. So you don't have to go to a methadone clinic.
So that's something to get somebody to not want to take opioids anymore.
Yeah, it helps. It helps.
It helps.
It can help. It can also be abused at times. But for an older adult, we've had a few folks that have went that route. But then they also need counseling and support, too.
Yeah. I'm joined in studio today by Brenda Isla. She is the executive director of the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation in Naples, and we're discussing the still growing issue of opioid dependence and abuse among senior citizens. I'm also joined by Claire Mannion, who has struggled with substance abuse herself, including to prescription opioids. So if you'd like to join our conversation, you're always invited to give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Now, Claire, I want to turn to you now. Tell me your story.
It's a long one. I was just thinking as Brenda was talking, which came first, the chicken or the egg. I've struggled with chronic pain issues for a long time. I honestly believe I've been an alcoholic all of my life, though I didn't start drinking until I was much older. But as I think about my age today, my peers and the people that I interact with on a daily basis, had I not gotten help at Hazelden Betty Ford, I would today be washing down all kinds of medication with a martini. Wouldn't have thought twice about it. Never thought twice before I got before I got there. My legal consequences caused me to seek treatment. I didn't think I needed it. But believe me, I absolutely did.
So when did you realize that you needed some help?
Probably in my heart, I didn't realize it until after I was admitted to treatment. My legal consequences are what caused me to seek it. So that light dawned very late for me, very late. I had taken opioids. I had taken medication for sleep and for pain and for anxiety probably all my life, certainly since my late 20s. At one point...
So you said you didn't really start drinking much until later in your life. Like, are you talking like late 20s, 30s?
30s.
Okay.
30s. I absolutely didn't understand the potency of the combination of the two. Mm-hmm. So had I not been educated, had I not gotten clean and sober, I don't know that I'd be alive today. I now fear it that much. I was thinking on the drive over here, I remember a time in my life when my anxiety levels were so high. I was probably in my 40s. I took Xanax, which is a benzo, around the clock. And I made a decision to stop. I can't even remember why. I made a decision to stop taking them. And what I know now today is that I had become addicted to it. What happened to my body going cold turkey off that one medication?
What just happened?
I was sick. I was itchy. I was jumping out of my skin. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I kept calling the doctor and saying, "I'm sick." I got the benzos from a therapist, and I kept calling the doctor saying, "There's something terribly wrong with me."
But did he know that you had been taking those? No.
No, because it never didn't even occur to me to say that.
As a medication, though, your doctor. Yeah.
Yeah. Never. I mean, I'm a Canadian by birth. And if the doctor says it, it must be so. If the doctor gives it to you, you take it.
Yeah, I think that kind of is – I've noticed when accompanying my grandparents to doctor's visits and things, it seems like older generations are not going to question what the doctor says.
Absolutely.
Never.
No.
Never. No. I was reading an article just before I came over here about doctor shopping. I did doctor shop. I just didn't know I was doing it. I was in pain. I had issues, sleep, anxiety, and pain issues. I went to different doctors, and I actually did. I wasn't aware that I was doing it, mm-hmm. but in retrospect, I absolutely was doing it. If this one gave me a prescription for X, I went to that one and complained about something else, and I got a prescription for Y. I took them together, and I washed it down with alcohol. I mean, I say to myself, how crazy was that? But I did it, and I had no clue what I was doing.
Do you look back now and think, man, I can't believe I made it out alive?
I'm horrified. Exactly. Absolutely horrified. And I see my contemporaries doing the same thing. And they are just as poorly informed as I was years ago.
Well, how do your contemporaries react if you say something like, that's probably not a good idea? Do they look at you askance and say, like, oh, come on?
Probably.
Yeah.
They probably react much the way I would have. Oh, you don't know what you're talking about. I mean, why would I? And so, you know, it's a very fine line. I encounter people who do it all the time. It's not my job to fix it for them, but do I want to share with them what my experience has been and what I imagine my experience would be today? Sure. Doesn't always go so well.
So did your path kind of go with having pain, using alcohol to kind of help with that, but then upping that with the anxiety medication and then eventually move to opioids? Or was it always the trifecta?
I think it was always the trifecta. I'm a high energy person. I'm involved in a million things. I can run on adrenaline a lot. So I think it was always the trifecta.
So how do you handle that now?
Oh.
Because the anxiety didn't go away, did it?
Well,
did some of the medication and stuff cause some of that anxiety or exacerbate things?
Oh, I think they all fed into each other. So, yes, I think the anxiety is completely different now. My head is clear. When I knew that I had to submit myself to treatment, I went shopping for, you know, via computer and telephone for a treatment center. And I had two criteria. One, I needed my cell phone. And the other, I wasn't going to go to detox. Don't ask me why. I just made up my mind I didn't need that, because on the day I got that last DUI, I stopped drinking. I didn't know at that point that all the other medication I had was also running in my system and messing me up. So I found one on the other coast. The answer wasn't as clear from Hazelden Betty Ford. Of course, when I went to that front door and decided that was the place I was going to stay, I spent 8 days in detox.
Yeah.
8 days.
Which is real common with folks who are 50 and older, because they metabolize alcohol and drugs so different that detoxes are longer, mm-hmm. you know, and then
really?
The benzo detoxes are make things even longer. But
they couldn't get my blood pressure down. And I couldn't, I didn't know what I know then, what I know today. But, yeah, 8 days before they would allow me to go back over from the hospital. So, it was a scary proposition.
What did you feel like at the end of those 8 days? Did you feel lighter or cleaner or scared?
Oh, scared. Mm-hmm. Absolutely scared. Terrified, actually. I didn't know what was coming. I'm a pretty well-informed person. I have a family member who struggles with these issues. I thought I had written the book on treatment centers, and I didn't know the first thing about them, really. I just thought I did. I'm of an age. I was well-informed. I was well-read. I didn't know what detox was going to be like, and then I realized I had no idea what was coming when I went to treatment.
Well, what comes after that detox then? Then are you rebuilding?
Completely. But rebuilding, educating, practicing, rebuilding, educating, practicing. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me in my life.
Brenda, I wanted to ask you, is that kind of where the difference lies when you're dealing with someone who is later in life rather than, you know, maybe a 18, 19, 20, 30-year-old? You're dealing with people who've already lived a life. Now they're 100% rebuilding.
Well, but the good news is they've got stable building blocks to rebuild on. So they've had lives. They just need to get back to those lives without the chemicals. And a lot of times people are like Claire. They're scared to death because I've been on these benzos or these pain pills, and there's that rebound fear of—
For sometimes decades.
Yeah, sometimes decades, particularly for women with the benzodiazepines.
Which is the anxiety medications?
The anxiety medications, you know. So helping people, but also they're rebuilding, but they at least have a stable foundation in the past to build on. Claire had a fantastic career. She's got huge people skills. She's got resources. So a lot of times the recovery rates for people who are older are much greater. They're also, what we find is you say, okay, now We're going to go out to these support meetings, generally Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. They're compliant. You say, here's an anti-medication, anti-craving medication. They take their meds. So it's much easier. A lot of folks that we see are in outpatient. They just want to get education, learn what really happened, what came into my life. Oh, my God, it's this combination of medications. And then off they go into the world again.
We have a call coming in from Daniel in Captiva. Daniel, thank you for waiting on the line. What would you like to add?
Thanks for having me. I just want to say thank you for the topic, because this is such a huge epidemic all over the place, all over the country. I'm a recovering addict.
Congratulations.
I've been on Suboxone. I've been to several different treatment centers. I was on Medicare at the time I was going through it. And my biggest thing was finding any kind of treatment center that actually accepted Medicare. There's like only a handful of them that I ever learned about. But the biggest thing that, you know, really helped me, I would go to 30-day programs, and I will start with a detox, then I'll go to a 30-day program, and usually finding a place to go after it was almost impossible, especially being on Suboxone at the time. But even so, that didn't 100% work with me. I usually ended up relapsing. It wasn't until my last detox center and then going into a meeting and asking for help and getting into a halfway house. That's what worked the best for me. Now I'm almost 2.5 years clean.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And it saved my life.
Can you tell
me,
Daniel,
design a couple.
How old are you, Daniel?
I'm 35.
Okay. So you've gone through it at a younger age.
Yeah. And probably, yes. Did you have access to Medicare at 35? Because usually that's 65 and
yes.
older. Or are you talking
yes,
about?
Yes, I did. Okay. I had access to Social Security disability because of mental
Medicaid.
Illness.
Medicaid. Yep. Mm-hmm. Good. Good.
And I was on Medicare with it.
Well, Daniel, congratulations.
I was diagnosed with bipolar when I was 15 years old and went through the loop.
And
I think we just lost him.
Oh, shoot. Daniel.
No, I'm here.
Oh, wait, there
okay.
you are. It just kind of crinkled on you. Did you hear that sound?
Yeah.
We heard it over here. Well, Daniel,
yeah,
I want to say
it.
Congratulations on two and a half years, you said?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, good job.
Wonderful. And the piece Daniel speaks to well is the fact that people need ongoing support, whether they get that through their 12-step community, whether he got it through a halfway house, whether they get that through their churches, some people get it through their families, but support is so crucial in ongoing recovery for folks.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask both of you about, probably Claire also, you already had an anxiety issue before.
Mm-hmm.
How do you handle anxiety after addiction treatment? Do you approach life differently? Do you have a different set of coping mechanisms that you're able to rely on?
Well, I think it's twofold. I do approach life differently because of what I learned there, but not just what I learned, what I began to practice. And so I live my life differently. It's framed differently. I begin my day at home the same way I began it at Hazelden, with the same readings. I learned about meditation. I lived in the West for a long time and learned about all kinds of alternative things, but I didn't really access them. Today I really do. And I access the 12-step support that's out there. I am one of those people that's there to help, but I also ask for help from others. So that fellowship is tremendously important to me. I continue to go back and be available to people who are newly discharging from Hazelden to help them reintegrate into the community, because that really helped me. And so my day looks differently. I'm talking to another addict alcoholic of some age every single day, and I go to meetings almost every day of my life. And I see that as my opportunity and my choice. It's an added piece of my day, not something that I take away from my old day.
Mm-hmm. Brenda, how hard is it, though, when you're dealing with someone, for example, Daniel, he has bipolar disorder. How hard is it to deal with other pre-existing mental illness post-addiction? I mean, addiction would compound things, I think, sometimes make them worse.
Yes, addiction always makes it worse. So our main focus is on how do we get people sober. But we also need to give people tools for other issues. For instance, if someone has chronic pain, then what are some tools that can be helpful? Or they're going to be back to using the opioids again. Or like Claire spoke about anxiety, what are some tools that can be helpful that are evidence-based? I mean, at Hazelden Betty Ford, we believe you need to look at what does the research say is helpful. And for anxiety, it's pretty clear. It's exercise. It's changing the way you think, cognitive behavioral therapy, which the 12-step program really helps people that, with those type of things, you know, getting out of yourself, focusing on others, finding purpose again. And then also medications can be helpful for people. But that doesn't mean they need to be addictive medications, such as what Claire was on. So it really gets individualized for people.
I think it's really interesting, too, that we're talking about seniors with opioid addiction, because I think that when people become seniors, they're facing things in their life like pain.
Absolutely.
And sometimes grief. And occasionally loneliness, a difference because you're retired and you don't have, you know, to get somewhere at 9 o'clock every morning or 8:30 every morning. Your job thing is different. And we just heard these staggering numbers about suicide in older Americans, well, all Americans, but also older Americans. And we were talking before we came on the show, how do you help people cope with these other things that could have led them towards the opioids?
Absolutely. It's usually a perfect storm, and loss of purpose is a huge part of that storm for people. You know, people that I remember one guy coming in and saying, yeah, I ran 6 businesses and I'm big in the philanthropic world, and I have no idea what I'm doing in a place like this. And he had no idea. Another person called himself an FIP, a formerly important person. You know, people, whether it's a role of being a caretaker of kids or being a caretaker of the family calendar or being a big shot in business or being a great worker, we lose those roles a lot of times as we age, and it can be really disheartening for people.
And to totally hyper-localize that, I've always felt like that FIP, the formerly important person, can really hit people in the face when they retire to Naples. Because you may feel important in your town in the Midwest that you came from or wherever.
But you are.
But
all
of
a sudden,
fish.
You're just another person with a shopping cart
in
this community.
Yeah.
You know? And
because
so,
here, there's a lot of very, very big fish from other
much bigger ponds. Yes, there
are. And you can kind of maybe feel a little small. And if that's how you kind of defined yourself. And that was another thing that we were talking about earlier, is how people define themselves and what makes them who they are, makes them valuable in the world. If that changes, like women and their looks fading, you know, things like that, men and their business acumen not coming to the fore every day when they wake up, how those kinds of changes can kind of lead to that.
And I feel like this is a subject that is very hard to address openly. I find if I'm gathered with, let's say I'm gathered with a group of women, everybody has, you know, that word retire is a seemingly positive word, but are we retiring from something or retiring to something? And when people, or my contemporaries, when we've retired from something, it's if there's nothing to go to, then it's beyond a lack of purpose. It's who am I? What am I? Why am I? And I encounter that all the time. And if I push back, I find that 9 people out of 10 in a social group will hype, you know, oh, that I love to play golf. I love to play cards. I love to eat. They don't say I love to drink, but that goes with it. And that's it. Now, that sounds empty to me. It may feel empty to them, but nobody says it. It's that big pink pregnant elephant in the middle of the room. And I think it's underneath so many things. I mean, there's loss of purpose. There's loss of your role, as Brenda was saying, as you knew it. Loss of friends. You retire from the Midwest to Florida. You don't know anybody.
Well, yeah, and usually your kids can't afford to come live here.
Right. And, you know? And how do you meet people? And, you know, it's so complicated, but so present and real. Every conversation I have with contemporaries, it comes up.
I want to ask you, what would you say, Claire, to a contemporary who, you know, found themselves with, you know, a second DUI and doesn't understand where it came from or what the big deal is? Or what would you say to yourself maybe a few years ago or several years ago?
If that were me?
Yeah. I mean, what kind of advice would you give your past self?
Oh.
Because there are people out there who yeah. are where you once were.
Yeah, that's a good way to think of it. I would say to my past self, you're in trouble. It's okay to talk about it. It's a reach for help. Reach for somebody that might have been in this situation. Ask for help. Talk to a doctor. Talk to a friend. Talk to somebody else who you know might have struggled with the problem. I don't happen to have children, but talk to to an adult child who may be noticing that it's happening and not know how to address a parent. Sometimes talking to a spouse can be complicated because you're both in denial that it's really happening. Mm-hmm. But reach out to somebody who might be able to be there for you and meet you where you are. So often I hear people trying to talk each other out of their consequences or their situation. Nah, you don't really drink so much. I had a friend when I first was in the program who I went to visit on an overnight visit. And when I walked in, she was having a drink and it surfed around to conversation about my situation. She said, Claire, you're not really an alcoholic, are you? I mean, what would make you say you're an alcoholic? And I said, it's really simple. I can't drink safely. With that, she got up and made herself another drink. And that was okay with me. But that friend, she cared about me deeply, but she didn't really want to know what my situation was. So I realized that, you know, it's my issue. It's my problem. I don't really care who drinks around me, who does what. I know that I can't drink safely. Even if I'd known that back then, I didn't realize that I was the culprit behind my own issues.
Mm-hmm.
I created many of them because I have this disease, and it's a disease of more. I want more and more and more, and I'm not aware that I'm doing it. Looking back, wow, I see so much about my former self in retrospect. So I'm very blessed to be here and be having this conversation.
I'm sure you look at people having these conversations, you're like, am I looking at a mirror from 15 years ago? Because
oh, it happens all the time. I nod my head and I'm going, I get it. I get it. I've been there.
Yeah. I said that exact sentence 15 years
exactly.
ago.
Oh, sure. Exactly.
Wow. Yeah. But what can people expect? You know, maybe somebody's hearing Claire and they're like, oh, maybe I do drink a little too much. I mean, but I don't really want to have to. Can people just go check it out and learn?
Sure, they could. You know,
what do they do when they get to the front door?
Well, it depends on, you know, where they think they might have a problem. So, if they're seeking treatment, I would encourage them give Hazelton Betty Ford a call or another provider. But sometimes people may, as Claire said, go talk to their clergy or their healthcare provider. Or if they're looking around drinking, there's a place on our website called aboutmydrinking.org where you can put in your numbers and see, might that be a problem?
Everybody loves an online quiz.
Yeah, well, and it's anonymous, you know. And the piece I love about that particular one is you can put in your partner's information and get some information back too. Like, might there be a problem here? If you're worried about someone, just like Claire said, be honest. I'm really concerned about you. You seem to have been, you know, moved to Florida and you were so vibrant when you moved here and now you seem depressed. Or since I've heard all this media about the suicides recently, I've asked people I love, do you ever think about it? Do you ever? Because we need to take those pink elephants that are in the living room and start talking about them. Put it out there.
Well, and I also think it's try to remove the shame in our own judgments.
Yes.
There was a lot of shame for me. Just a huge amount. I would never have guessed that I'd be sitting here having this conversation on a radio station and being enthused to do it. But there's so much shame. And so we're afraid to address it in others. And probably I would have spit back if somebody had brought it up to me. And I did to those closest to me. But it registered. Someplace it registered. So I still believe today that it's worth the effort. To say I'm concerned.
Even though someone does push you away.
Absolutely.
Even if you say something, they push you away, it does get stuck somewhere back in the gray matter.
Absolutely.
And it's always helped to bring it back to a medical issue too, if you can, particularly with an older adult. Claire's not older, but
sure she is.
You know, but I'm wondering if
I know when you guys came into the studio. I got to be honest. I was like, she doesn't fit the profile of the.
Oh, no, she's a pretty classy lady. But the profile, there is no profile. That's part of the stigma that there's a profile of an addict out there. This is the profile of an addict. I'm a profile of an addict. There, you know, these are people who are vibrant, in recovery, living life, dealing with their chronic pain if they have it, dealing with their anxiety, part of different groups in society. So,
well, and when I was first at Hazelden Betty Ford, they began this module for the older adult, and I remember, and I happened to be fortunate enough to be in the first one. But I think we were maybe four or five in that group, and there was one gentleman in there who referred to us as the Old Farts Club, and. And as we progressed through that time there, I was one to say, we can't call ourselves that. Mm. This is terrible.
That's part of the
stigma. We were doing it to ourselves by saying, oh, God, look at us. And I was doing it, too. But
well,
I've learned.
As the baby boomer generation retires, we've learned that there is no really mm-hmm. definition of senior. They're very active people, and they're out there, and they're vibrant and wanting to be part of their community and the world,
I'm
too.
As active as I've ever been, if not more so.
And they
I'm
have a
thrilled.
Voice, and they want to use it. Mm-hmm. You know, they used it in the 60s. They're going to use it in this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's about all the time we have for this segment. But I got to tell you, I really appreciate this conversation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks.
And we have links on our website to Hazelden Betty Ford and a couple little other links to helpful places on the internet. So if you needed to either re-listen to this show or you wanted to share it with someone, check WGCU.org and go to Gulf Coast Live. You can find this story there. But I want to thank you, Brenda Iliff, Executive Director from the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation in Naples. Thanks for coming in again.
Thank you.
Claire, really, thanks so much for sharing your story.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
When we return, we're going to turn our attention to the growing problem of homelessness among our senior citizens in Collier County. The Hunger and Homeless Coalition of Collier County added a new category for senior homelessness to its annual homelessness survey this year for the first time ever. So we're joined in the studio by the organization's executive director to explore the factors behind that trend. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us. Thank you.